I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, dykes and dyke-adjacent folks and allies, and maybe my uncle, who I learn sometimes listens to this podcast. Hi, how are you all? If you are a regular listener, you've probably noticed that we've been re-releasing some of our favorite episodes for the past couple of months while Melody and I took some time off. And as some of you, many of you, might have assumed, after over 5 years of diking out every week, this podcast, as you know it, cue the violin, is coming to an end. But please stay subscribed to this. It doesn't cost you anything. Just don't change anything. Simple, right? Because there's always the possibility of special episodes dropping here, because there are so many incredible folks that I personally want to dike out with that I haven't yet. And if they come back around into the fold, who knows what will happen and if that will happen in this space. Also, if you have never been a patron of the podcast, or maybe you were a patron a while ago, we were recording extra episodes every week, anywhere from 20 to 50 minutes sometimes, talking more about our personal lives and things we were watching, things we were doing outside of our regular episodes. And those all still exist on Patreon, and we're gonna leave that up there a little while longer because we are still, you know, struggling artists, comedians. And you can go to patreon.com/dykingout. All that content will be there if you miss listening to us. There's so much more there that maybe you haven't listened to yet. Also, this is where I'm going to tell you about an upcoming project of mine. I'm going to be launching a new podcast. What? Crazy, right? Can you believe it? Probably, because I've already launched a new podcast back in August. Some of you know I did a limited run recapping the new-ish now Amazon Prime show, A League of Their Own, where I got to recap episodes episodes with some of the writers from that show. Even the showrunner did an episode, some people from behind the scenes, and also other really cool people that I had so much fun recapping those episodes with. This new podcast actually has nothing to do with that, but I do want to remind you to watch or rewatch that show. I've been meeting so many people who are like, oh, I haven't watched it yet. And I'm like, yeah, that's why it hasn't been renewed for a second season. It hasn't been canceled, but it hasn't been renewed. And I think that's a hate crime against our community because it's too good. It is, I will say, it's the most sapphic show on TV in the past year. And that's including anything on Showtime. I was going to say no shade, but all the shade, like it's so sapphic. It's so good. And we should be supporting shows like this. I'm just so afraid, like if we don't watch it, they'll never let us have nice things again. Okay. So go watch, support A League of Their Own. And if you like the show, you can check out my A League of Their Own recap podcast. But I also have a new podcast that's going to be coming out soon, hopefully in the next couple of weeks. I'll be giving you some more information about it very, very soon. I'm so excited about it. It's going to be queer. It's going to be funny, at least I hope. And it's going to be very different than Dyking Out. And I hope that some of you, or most of you, or all of you, or all of you plus your friends, follow me to that new podcast. But this is where you'll first hear about it. Also on my Instagram, if you're following me, at TGICAROLYN. And also a couple other things I want to tell you. So Cecilia and I, for New Year's Eve, we went on a little trip to Washington, D.C. to storm the... No, just kidding. We went to D.C. and I wanted to ring in the New Year's at a bar called As You Are. And I hope that's a familiar name to a lot of you. It's Joe McDaniel, who's been a past guest of the pod, and her partner, Coach. They opened a bar about a year ago called As You Are. It's in DC, and I want to encourage all of you to visit if you're ever in the area. And they are just so great. They've poured so much work into creating this beautiful queer space for the community, and it serves so many people in our community. They are so mindful with everything that they do. There's a cafe with great food downstairs, and then a bar upstairs, and then a space next to it that's more for like chilling, and you could do video games and stuff if you're not into drinking, or even if you are into drinking, you can drink and play video games, right? And on New Year's Eve, it was just like such a great crowd. It just felt very inclusive and good vibes and warm. And we liked it so much. We came back the next night for karaoke night, which was actually my birthday, and had a great time catching up with the both of them. So As You Are in DC, check it out. Support queer spaces, especially queer spaces run by amazing folks. Okay. Another big thing that's happened since you last heard from me was that I was working on rewriting last year's, the L Word Christmas Carol script with my friend and past guest, Naomi Rege. So last year we put it on at Stonewall, and this year we moved it to a bigger venue in New York called Joe's Pub, where some of you might remember that I had my Dyke the Halls variety show there at the end of 2019. It's just like an iconic New York venue. I love it. There are a lot of queer performers that have shows there, and we had an amazing cast. Like last time, all past guests of this podcast, Laquette Charnel Pringle nailed the role of Bette. It was giving me life with our rewrites. It was truly bigger and better than last year, and we're planning an even bigger show for next year. So I hope that all of you who are in the area at the end of the year will be able to be there for that. It's so much fun. It brings me so much joy. And speaking of the L Word, instead of re-releasing another Dyking Out episode this week, I wanted to share a very, very cool interview that just released this week on the podcast Hot Takes and Deep Dives. My dear friend, Jess Rothschild, hosts that podcast. I've talked about it here so many times. She landed an interview with the one and only Eileen Chaiken, as in the creator and showrunner of the original L Word. So if you've never listened to Jess's podcast, you are missing out, first of all, because she has landed interviews with so many amazing dykons. One specific episode I'll point you to after you listen to this one you're about to hear is an interview with Guinevere Turner. So if that name's not familiar, you might remember her more as Gabby DuVoe on the original L Word series, and you'll learn so much more about her. She's truly iconic, and that deserves a listen. But this episode you're about to hear, I learned a lot of great things, especially something about my all-time favorite scene in the L Word. So I hope you enjoy listening to this, and I'll be back with some updates soon. I hope you're all having a safe and happy new year and keeping it gay.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome back to Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and my next guest needs no introduction. She is the creator and showrunner behind The L Word. Hi, Eileen Chaiken. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing all right.
You're doing
all things considered.
I know. So you just got back from a trip, and you got COVID on the way home. Where were you on your vacation?
It wasn't a vacation, although it was a wonderful, epic trip. We were in Kenya for a couple of weeks, and then on the way home, stopped in London to see my daughter. And I think, you know, we're well and healthy throughout the entire time, and then got COVID at Heathrow on the way home.
Oh my God. You've been able to pinpoint it to Heathrow.
I'm being presumptuous, but... Heathrow was, can I like say whatever I want?
What, truly whatever you want, yes.
So Heathrow was a clusterfuck. Oh. Can I say that?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just reacting.
Right. It was just pre-holiday time. There were hordes and hordes of people. There were people coughing and sneezing. And I was an idiot and didn't wear my mask.
But this is interesting. So you say so I know that you have twin daughters who were old when you wrote the pilot or filmed the first season? How old were they?
Six.
And so they must be what? In their mid-20s now?
They're 27.
That is unbelievable. So can I ask like what they are doing, like what they do for work?
One of them lives in Los Angeles. She's an artist, a sculptor, and a furniture maker. She went to RISD, which is my alma mater.
Yes.
And her twin lives in London and is a chef, a fabulous chef. They're both gorgeous and brilliant.
Now, I want to first kick things off by telling you a highlight of my holiday season this year and last year was going to see a staged reading. I'm not sure if you know that this is going on. Maybe not because you were around the world. But it was going to see a staged reading written by my brilliant friend, Carolyn Bergier, of an L Word Christmas carol that was she put up at Joe's Pub. And this is a story of a Christmas carol that is told through the lens of the L Word, and Dana, Kit, and Jenny play the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future.
Why do I not know about this, and why wasn't I there?
Listen, this is an open invitation for Christmas 2023. Will you please join us and bring everyone you know?
I will do everything I can to be there.
Awesome. This is the last year she did it at Stonewall, and this year it was at Joe's Pub.
I love that.
Incredible, right? And they're definitely doing it again. Like, she has a brilliant cast of, like, comedians, and the woman who played Bette is a Broadway actress and singer, and there's a moment where Bette sings. There's also a Bette and Tina sex scene. They're sitting in chairs, mind you.
This just gets better and better.
So I just had to share that with you. You know, you've described the L Word as kind of like a whimsical and fun idea that you just wanted to get on the air. Like, you didn't have that much experience in television. You really were behind the scenes as an executive. Can you kind of talk about your work? Like, I was on the floor reading that you worked for Aaron Spelling. Like, what, describe the life of an executive versus a creative.
Okay, so there's a little gap in there. I had been an executive. The first 10 years of my career, I was an executive. But I always intended, wanted, meant to, was born to be a writer. That's why I came to LA. I left my executive life and was a screenwriter, I think, for almost 10 years. I had no experience writing television, but I had been writing movies. But I had no experience nor any interest in doing television at the time. It was before television was cool. but I did, during my executive career, learn television at the feet of Aaron Spelling.
So what shows, I mean, were you around for 90210?
No, I left just before 90210. I started as a development executive, but wound up running the television department for Spelling, probably during the most fallow part of his entire career. I mean, really, you know, he had the most extraordinary television career. When I was running his company, it sucked. I mean, we tried to do some cool things and we did one or two, but it wasn't his heyday. Dynasty was on the air. I think Hotel was on the air. I tried to develop a bunch of cool shows. The coolest thing I did at Spelling was I put together a show called Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And so we did Twin Peaks, but that wasn't a classic Spelling show. That was a David Lynch show.
And so was it your idea to get the two of them together?
It was. Yeah.
Wow. And what was your life? I guess describe a week or a day in the life of Eileen Chaikin. What were you in your 20s at this point as an executive?
So here are the important things. You had to get up and go to an office job every day. You had to get dressed and think about what I was wearing. Mm-hmm. It was usually high heels and some little skirt, mini skirt thing. You know, I mean, it was, we're talking back in the day. And even before I worked for Aaron Spelling, I had had several jobs in the entertainment industry. And mind you, this was the early 80s. It was pre many things. It was pre AIDS. It was pre Me Too. It was when bad, abusive male behavior was the order of the day. And I was told all kinds of things. I was once told, I won't say where I was working at the time, but if you want to be successful at this company, you have to be fuckable, but you can't be fucked with. So that was what Hollywood was like back then. I have all kinds of lurid stories from my 10 years as an executive. Please don't make me tell them.
Well, this actually, so this spurs like two immediate questions. The more kind of shallow question is, did any of this play into your decision to make Tina on the L Word an executive?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And secondly, were you out as an executive?
I was. I didn't know how not to be out. It wasn't a conscious decision. It wasn't a political decision. I was kind of hapless. I was in a relationship. I was actually in a 20-year relationship, the mother of my children. My children were not yet born. I went everywhere with her and I was just out.
Like when you're saying that it was kind of like a boys' club, obviously, and this was pre-Me Too, did being gay play a certain way? Like, do you think it helped you in any way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that it was a challenge and it hurt in some ways, but I think it helped more than it hurt.
Yeah. I would imagine it helping. Yeah. I mean, even just in like my career, like the people I've worked for, I noticed that in a way it helps.
People were intrigued. Men were intrigued. And it was something distinctive and memorable.
Now, I know that you based the Jenny and Marina, the germ of that relationship was actually based on your kind of coming out story. Like you have this wild story of like crashing your car a few times in front of this cafe and you fell in love with, or what, I don't know if you fell in love, but like you basically, you know, had an affair with this cafe owner. What drew you, or what was the allure of going to this cafe every day after work as an executive?
I knew it was run by lesbians and I needed to come out. This was mid 80s. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to do it. I knew no gay people, and particularly I knew no lesbians.
And so how did you find out that it was owned by two lesbians?
I don't remember, but they were kind of LA famous.
Ah, okay. What was the name of that cafe?
It doesn't exist anymore, but I'm not going to say because I don't think I should name names.
Okay.
They know who they are.
I mean, it inspired the planet. I mean, clearly this is the inspiration for the planet. I mean, they should.
No, I mean, there are loads of people in the L Word who were inspired, not the actual basis, but who were inspiration for various characters. And most of them know it and most of them are delighted by it. Yeah. But I don't think it's fair to name them.
It's interesting. I interviewed this woman, Jackie Warner. She was a personal trainer. She had a reality show called Workout on Bravo that was basically all the drama of her running in this gym. And she was dating Jillian Michaels for a long period of time. So I was interviewing her about this TV show she did. And in the interview, she talked about how she and Jillian used to run these like lesbian nightclubs. And it sounded very much like the Dawn Dembo, like the rivalry. Like the way she was describing it, I was like, girl, this was on TV. I've seen this.
I know of them, but I don't know them. I used to have a hairdresser who was very friendly with one of them.
Going back to Aaron Spelling, I know that you have this philosophy when arcing out a season-long arc that I've heard of this Eileen Shaken quote, burn it down, meaning like whatever you start, have, is this news to you?
But I'm intrigued.
Well, I'm interpreting it as the way you arc out a season, wherever you start in the beginning, we're most likely going to end in the opposite direction by the time we hit the finale. Was this learned from the school of Aaron Spelling?
Not explicitly, but I'm sure that in some ways I kind of absorbed lessons. I never aimed to make the kind of television Aaron Spelling made, but I learned a great many things about storytelling, in particular, actually about the importance of post-production, about how you can fix a show in post, which was one of Aaron's great skills. But the way that you described a season arc is not exactly the way I've approached making television, but I'm sure that there's something to the idea that I really believe in surprises. I believe in dynamic change. I want things to happen. I want there always to be something gasp-worthy in every episode and in every season, and I want it to be consequential. I don't think there's any point in telling these stories if we're not just blowing people sideways.
Right. You know, I'm curious where you stand nowadays on queer actors playing queer roles. Like, obviously, you've cast both. Like, this is still of a bit of a controversial topic. Yeah. Like, where do you stand on that? And has your position on that evolved over the years?
My position has definitely evolved. I'm kind of open and listening. I do believe that non-gay actors can play gay characters just as gay actors can play non-gay characters. And then I think there's a whole range of identity issues that are not fungible or permeable, and we know what they are, and we have to just accept intuitively that there are some things that are really necessary and important. The issue that I get called out on all the time is Max and the portrayal of trans characters. And I acknowledge that it was far from perfect. And there was a lack of understanding that reflected a whole cultural lack of understanding. I'm thrilled that in the new iteration of the L Word, Marja got to readdress that character and make the kinds of, I don't want to say make amends, I just want to say acknowledge the present.
The actor who plays Max, Daniel C., has spoken publicly about how he very much didn't feel part of the cast because he wasn't a, quote, woman, and how he was, his account, how he was mistreated on set in different ways. Were you aware of this at the time?
I was aware that there was friction and misunderstanding. Daniel was not at least out and openly trans at the time. I didn't even know what trans was when I started doing the L Word. And we were talking about masculine identity. We were talking about shades of identity. And then as we came to know more, we were interested in the idea that Max would come out as trans. And we portrayed it in the way we knew. And we actually did quite a lot of research and met with a lot of F2M trans folks and learned what we thought was the truth.
Right.
And that's separate from Daniel's personal experience, which also, I think, was, how shall I say, redressed in the current iteration. I think that Daniel had a chance to reconnect with a lot of the other actors he worked with back in the day, and they all have evolved in many ways. And that was lovely to see.
I know that Kate Menig had said, speaking of this scene with Max, which was actually really great, saying how she thought it would make the most sense, because she had quite, I would say, the Max character had like the most amount of scenes, probably with Jenny and Shane, since they lived together in the show.
Yeah.
She was saying how it really would make the most sense to be like, to bring up the topic of Jenny, and how she was trying to fight for that, but like didn't win that. What is the issue with, it seems like they really don't want to bring up Jenny, like, do you have any insight?
It's not my call or my place to speak on. I don't make those decisions. I'm not in the day-to-day of the show. And I can only assume that the writers and showrunner had something in particular they wanted to talk about, and it wasn't that.
Take me into the casting of Jennifer Beals. Did she audition for the role?
No. No. But when Showtime ordered the L word from me, when they ordered the pilot, the president of the network, was a man called Jerry Offsay, to whom I'm forever grateful, said, just, you know, I want you to know that we're going to make this show. You just cast the best actors. You're not going to get anybody with a name to play this because, you know, we've already had this experience on Queer as Folk. Nobody wants to play gay characters. And I said to myself in my inner voice, I'm not sure that's going to be true with women, but great. You know, we'll cast the best actors. And then when the casting call first went out, we made some reaches. And the biggest reach was the Dream casting. And I was just utterly flabbergasted when I heard that Jennifer was interested and wanted to meet.
So she was in place first, and then you were casting a lot of people against her for the role of Tina.
Yes.
What was it that made all of you collectively decide on Laurel Holloman?
It was that Laurel's audition was the best. She just felt like Tina, and it was wonderful, and they had chemistry. But there was something else, and I've always worked like this ever since. Jennifer felt it. Jennifer was making a movie at the time, so we did a couple of tapings, and she called me afterwards and she said, there's just no question. This is the person that I connect with. And that's really important when you're making a television show.
And you had said how your original plan was not to put Bette and Tina back together after season one. If the audience hadn't so deeply connected to the two of them, suppose the audience had been indifferent, would you just have had them go off in different relationships? Like, what was your broader plan with those two characters?
I don't know ultimately what would have happened, but I just had one intention. It had nothing to do with Tina or Laurel. It was just a story that I had planned to tell. And the story that I had planned to tell, because I aimed to tell, you know, the lesbian stories, the stories that represented our lives and experience. And one of the stories I knew from experience was that there are any number of women who come out, who spend a couple of years in gay relationships and then go back to men. And Tina, you know, as we posited her, Bette was her first woman lover. It hadn't occurred to her, or at least not consciously, that she might be gay. She was with a man when she met Bette, and that was the character that would spend 3 years in a relationship and then say, oh my God, no, I've got to go back to men. So that was what I was planning. And I just had no idea that Bette and Tina were going to be such a powerful couple.
You know, the reason I am most drawn to Bette is actually the way you had written the trajectory of her career. I think it's among the strongest in episodic television, like unlike a Grey's Anatomy, like they're just doctors for the 20 years the show is on the air. And so I always found it highly entertaining how she would be fired from these very high positions. And I always found it really creative, like the idea to make her like the dean of the university. It felt like a lot of care was taken with the writing around her career. Where did those ideas stem from? Or is that just the writer's room pitching a bunch of different ideas?
Well, it is the writer's room, but no, those ideas stemmed from real life experience and people that I know. And I mean, having spent a little bit of time in broadcast television, I found it very frustrating that people were stuck in those story engine jobs, that a cop was a cop and you couldn't change that. And I had a cop and I wanted her to run for mayor. And it was like, but no, the series isn't about that. But that's what life is about. So with the L Word, with Showtime, we had these opportunities to really explore life. Beth's career was the one that I felt closest to, most drawn to, because I came out of an art background, and so many of my friends are gallerists, museum curators, artists, and so on. And one of the things that those folks do is teach.
It's very clearly laid out that the character's mother left her when she was young. And of course, Ossie Davis was so brilliant as her father. Those episodes Truly. With her father are among my favorites. Even as he's passing away, I think they're just so brilliantly acted. In a fantasy casting world, was there any actress that you would have loved to see as Beth's mom?
I think you have to ask that question of Jennifer. She's had those fantasies many times over. I don't recall having fantasized. I think we probably did have those conversations, but I couldn't pluck the names for you. And I know that it's very fresh for her.
It's very fret for her? Like, did she... fresh for her. Mm-hmm. Did she want her... And I know that in Gen Q, like, the story of the mother comes, you know, has come back around. Was there ever an idea that we were going to see her mother on screen?
I think we probably considered it, but I'm sure we considered it. And that's one that we certainly would have rolled around.
The closest thing to seeing Beth's mom, I think, is probably having Holland Taylor there as Peggy Peabody. And this is like before Holland Taylor was... I mean, who could have predicted how popular she would become? I mean, she was Legally
Blonde. Taylor was always fabulous.
Of course. But like, I mean, maybe I'm just viewing this through like L Word colored lenses. But how did Holland Taylor come to be Peggy Peabody?
Well, the character preceded Holland. But once Holland became Peggy Peabody, she never existed until Holland came along. But you know, the character, again, was inspired by a number of powerful women I've known in the art world who, you know, rich, powerful women who run boards and who have fabulous daughters who are my friends and peers. So you can gather that I'm talking about, you know, any small group of people I might have known. And we knew that Beth would know those women. And it was a funny, fun, intriguing storyline. Angela Robinson had a lot to do with the actual execution of that character. And then Holland was actually a friend of mine. And I had always wanted to work with her, but I met Holland through a friend of mine, an actress called Suzanne Burdish, a British actress. We hung out. And then when I got to actually bring a part to Holland, it was just a treat.
I love that. I love the idea of you and Holland Taylor and Sarah Paulson just getting dinner.
It was way before Sarah.
No, I know. But I'm sure present day, I love it. All right, moving on from Beth and Jennifer Beals, I want to talk about the casting of Kate Menig as Shane. And you had said that you were the most nervous about casting Shane. Like, you didn't know if anybody could really capture what you had in your mind's eye. Like, what was it specifically about her? Like, was it the voice? Was it just like the easygoing nonchalance? What did you see in her tape?
Oh, everything. I mean, she was that was the character I was most nervous about, because there aren't a lot of actresses. There are a few more now that maybe could play a role like Shane, but certainly back then there were next to none. But also, I had an image in my head of this character. And when I saw Kate's audition tape, it was as if I had conjured her from whole cloth. I mean, she was 100% how I envisioned Shane. And then, of course, she brought so much more to it than I could ever imagine.
So in this case, did the person you choose have to be really close to the character? You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're like, oh, that's her, like, you're basing that off Kate.
I was all ready to compromise. I never in my wildest dreams thought that I was going to find an actor that was the Shane that I imagined. And I thought I'd cast somebody and let the character become whoever she was.
Right.
And then there was Kate.
And I know that, like, there was an original Showtime exec who I think, like, saw the tape of Kate and was like, I don't get it. Like, some guy.
Well, we brought Kate out from New York to audition after that tape. That was back in the days when we actually auditioned actors live, which we don't anymore.
Oh, you mean 20 years ago you weren't on Zoom?
Believe it or not. And we sat in this little room at Showtime and we auditioned a number of people. We auditioned Leisha Haley that day. We actually auditioned Leisha for the part of Shane. Mm-hmm. But there was just no question. There was, from the moment I saw her on tape to the moment she walked into that room, everything about Kate was Shane. But it was the same guy, the same president of the network, who just said to me, I don't get it. And it was easy to understand his not getting it. I mean, he was a middle-aged, straight, white man. And Kate is just something that that guy might not understand. And he said, I don't get it. But he turned to all of the women in the room. Me and my colleagues, Rose Trochet was there. There were a couple of other women that were part of our little cabal. And he said, but I can see that you all really believe in this, so I'm going to trust you.
You had said that he was basically like, okay, I'll give you Kate Menig as Shane, mm-hmm. but you got to do one for me and cast. Obviously, I don't know who this other person
is. It was Leisha. We wanted Leisha in the show anyway, but he loved Leisha and he wanted Leisha to be Shane. That was how he saw it. And he said, this actress is so incredible. She's just, I think that he said something. And if you knew this lovely man, you would find it funny too. He said, like, she's the arbiter of hipness. And
she kind of is.
Well, yeah, she is. But he got that, which is amazing. And I actually went back and created Alice for Leisha. And I don't know whether I wrote a whole new character or whether we just shaped a character.
So in a way, he was right. Like, he wasn't all wrong.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, he wasn't wrong. He just didn't get Kate. And believe me, he came back to me a year later and said, now I get it.
When it comes to Mia Kirshner, you had said that after the first year, like, obviously that first season was very much like based on your life, the Jenny Marina, like the germ mm-hmm. of Jenny. And mm-hmm. you said as the seasons went on, Jenny became complicated because Mia was complicated.
Mia is much more interesting than me. She's much more complex. She's much more provocative than I ever was. So, yes.
There was a ton of improv going on that would make it to the show. Was she the one who brought the most improvisation?
She brought a lot. Leisha also is a great improviser. There is one scene that's one of my favorite scenes between Jenny and Alice that was entirely improvised. And it went so off the rails, but it was brilliant. And the whole thing stayed in the show.
About like writing the book, right? Like like a joke about, she compares it to Monet.
That's right. That's the scene.
Hey, Alice, you know, there's this crazy weird thing that happens when you write as a writer.
Wait, is this a lesson in writing from Jenny Schechter?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Let me grab a pen.
Get a pad, too. So this thing that happens when you write is you draw from your own life. And then in turn, you take those experiences and you use something called imagination, Alice.
Oh, imagination. Yeah. God. So that's the thing you were lacking when you could barely change our names,
just
huh?
Just a second. You guys, do you hear that? Oh, my God, it's Monet. Monet has come back from the dead, and he wants me to give you a message. He says, I am so sorry for sitting in front of my pond in France and sketching those water lilies and using the water lilies as actual inspiration. Sorry to offend, Alice.
Right, right. Oh, wait, he's talking to me. So weird. It's crazy. Huh? Okay, I'll tell her. He said don't ever fucking compare yourself to him.
And I don't know where it came from, but I couldn't have written it, and it was brilliant. You know, Mia wasn't the only improviser, but Mia is really an actor's actor, and that's the school of acting that she comes from. And it really just was so rich and irresistible.
Something that I've really come to respect and admire about you is this very open door policy that you have with your actors, even when they are, like, forget about when the cameras are rolling, like, even like as you're prepping episodes or before going into a new season. Like, I know, like the Shane storyline with her brother, that was entirely Kate Manning's idea, and yes, you thought it was great. You're like, okay. Now, I've interviewed several showrunners and also a lot of television writers. And I know that you can put the most brilliant minds in a room, but at the end of the day, whatever Michael Patrick King says goes. And I really respect that you are open to hearing all ideas, even when the clock is ticking. How did you sort of harness this very collaborative style of show running?
Firstly, I didn't know what I was doing. I had never worked in television before. I had no mentors, no template. So some of it was just hapless foolishness. But there are all different ways of working, and I respect any number of ways of working. It's just how I like to work. I really like actors. I've found them to be great partners, brilliant collaborators, and I like to work with them. I like to work with writers too. I like to hear other people's ideas. And, you know, still as the showrunner, at a certain point, I have to make the ultimate decision. But that decision is largely informed by the collaboration that we have with any number of people. And I'm just a little bit more collaborative than some.
We talked about that scene where Jenny and Alice are fighting or having that like very fun moment. Is there anything else, a full episode or another scene that you can point to and think we really did something here?
It's really hard to do that over the course of the 6 years of the original show. There were many times when I felt that. There were times when I felt it on set, when I just would be sitting there watching the scene emerge and just thrill at the power or impact of what we were doing. There were times when I was cutting a show and I thought, wow, we really captured something.
Like, is there anything relating to, like, Bette and Tina, maybe specifically, if you just narrow it down to them?
There are so many Bette and Tina scenes and moments. The fight in, I think it's the finale of the first season, was really powerful to me.
Is there a particular season that's a favorite of yours?
There are moments in most seasons. I've said before, the one season I regret is season 6, and I'd rather not get into it, but it wasn't the best.
Yeah.
But 1 through 5, I loved the show. I loved making it. I loved telling the stories we told. And, you know, I was trying to end it in a cool, interesting way. And I think that maybe it wasn't the coolest and most interesting way.
Would you, let me ask you, you know, it's not about season 6, but curious, with Generation Q on the air, should we as an audience consider Gen Q to be canon, or would this be like an alternate timeline/universe?
I would say that Gen Q occupies the same space as the L Word. There is a lot of fan fiction. There are a lot of alternate stories, but Gen Q is the story of the L Word as it continues into the world, into the future.
I know obviously somebody else is running it, but I am curious, like, have you had any creative input, like, no matter how small?
Absolutely. I'm an executive producer on the show. Marja and I talk a lot. It's her show. She tells her stories. She comes to me sometimes for feedback, thoughts, running ideas around. There might be one or two things that originated with me, but for the most part, it's just me giving her supportive feedback.
Do you watch the show?
Of course.
Sometimes I do wonder, certain scenes are written by you. Some of the bet stuff, some of the speeches that she gives, I don't know. Someone's like, I don't know. Did I only go in there and rewrite this? I don't know. This is just me thinking out loud. You don't have to confirm or deny. Going back to Gen Q, you say that, you watch the show and you're really a fan of it. I often think of the character of Gigi and this actress, Sepeda Mwathi. I think as soon as she first came on screen, you could immediately see that she had that something special in her eyes.
Yes, she does. She absolutely does, truly. And I worked with Sepeda on a show some years before, after The L Word, when Marja created that character. Sepeda was on my list. And yeah, she's got it.
She feels like a character who exists in that sophistication and sort of fabulosity of the original, yes. Right? Yeah.
Yes, she does. She absolutely does. Mm-hmm.
The biggest fan reaction really was around Danny and Gigi. Were you privy to how intensely the fans reacted to that coupling?
I was certainly aware of it.
Pretty wild. It very much harkened back to the original.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Truly.
Quick little commercial break here just to let you know, if you are enjoying this interview with Eileen Chaykin and if The L Word is relevant to your interests, look for my episodes with Rosie O'Donnell, Guinevere Turner, Roxane Gay. I did a special on the Lesbian Bar Project. I interview the actors who play Emmett and Ted on the original Queer as Folk, Peter Page. I talked to Fortune Feimster about The L Word, plus Sandra Bernhard, Margaret Cho, Gina Gershon. So just letting you know, those episodes are out there. So just go find them on the podcast app or on YouTube. Let me ask you, in the original show, if you had more time, were there any storylines that you really wanted to do, but for whatever reason, you couldn't? Whether it be you ran out of time or you didn't have the actor?
There would be ancillary storylines. There were ideas that we had that got derailed for one reason or another. There was a minute where I was talking to this iconic Hollywood actress and I created a whole story for her and then she couldn't do it. And so I'm sure that we cast someone else and it became much, it became minor. Those are the kinds of things that, when they take off, they really take off, like with Holland Taylor.
How did it feel being on set again for episodes 9 and 10? You have the characters you created mixed now with these new characters. How important was it to you to be there during the filming of those events?
It felt incredible. It was thrilling. I don't go only for Jennifer, Kate, and Leisha, or Shane, Bette, and Alice. I really love the show. I love the new characters. They too feel like, I guess, maybe my stepchildren. I have a very warm feeling towards all of them. But certainly for something as important as the storyline you're talking about, I wanted to be there. It was for me that I was there. It was also thrilling that those two episodes were directed by Kate Menig and Leisha Haley.
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
During the course of the original show, were there any story decisions that you had to make outside of the story? I know, with Sarah Shahi had signed a 2-year deal, so she couldn't come back. Her career was taking off. What was the most challenging example of this, having to make a story decision outside of what you really wanted?
Well, the Sarah Shahi example is probably the most cogent. I would not have ended that relationship. Those two actors really cooked together, but we made a 2-year deal with Sarah and she had things to do. So I had to write her off the show. Were there any other decisions like that? Not in that way. I mean, I talked to you about, you know, the famous actress that, you know, strung me along and then dropped out. I had to make some quick pivots for that. But there was never any kind of, oh, you can't tell that story. Showtime was almost unfailingly supportive of the stories we wanted to tell. There was one episode in season one where we crossed a line they didn't want to cross.
Oh, what was that?
I'm not sure how to tell this story, but because there was no censorship whatsoever, but there, we did those cold opens in the first season and they all had to do with sex. And there was one, the opening sex scene was about autoerotic asphyxiation, and it was just not to someone's taste. And the executive said to me, I don't know. And it wasn't like a censorship note. It was a taste note. And I remember saying, well, okay, what if it was, it wound up being the opening in which an artist was portraying herself as Mary being fucked by Jesus or something like that.
Right.
And I pitched it as an alt. He said, yeah, that's good. I like that. So I think the point of the story is we were never reined in by morality, by any kind of censor's idea of what you can and can't say. And the only time anything came up was when, you know, an executive just said, I don't know if that's going to work for the audience.
You had said that you wanted to tell a breast cancer storyline. I'm wondering if there were any outside factors that played into Dana and Erin Daniels being written off the show.
Absolutely not. No. Erin was beloved. The character was beloved. We wanted to tell that story. And I believe that it was because when the writers got together in the beginning of the year, a number of us had experienced that kind of loss in our friend circles. And we wanted to tell a story of loss, life and death, loss among a group of lesbian friends, because it means something specific to us. It has a very specific poignancy. And the only real way to tell that story was to be willing to do the most difficult thing, and that is let a beloved character die.
You're the person that made this show that has really become like a shorthand way for people to connect and communicate, but yet you're also living in the community and like you're living in the world. What sorts of things did you hear back then? And even now, like I said, outside of Jenny and Dana, or what are the types of things that people say to you? I mean, I know people are shocked that Bette and Tina's pool isn't actually outside. Like, what are the more like funny things that people are surprised to find out or that people really want to know from you?
People talk about the L word to me a lot. And the things I usually hear are the things you want to hear.
You know, were you surprised? You know, it's been announced that Jennifer Beals is leaving the show. How did she tell you that she was going to leave? Were you surprised or had you kind of known?
Is it a fact that Jennifer is leaving the show? You know that she's in the first two episodes and the last two episodes of this season. I don't know if it's a fact, and I don't know that it's a fact. But, it, you know, in part, it was a personal decision having to do with things going on in her life. But Bette and Tina certainly will not end. I mean, you know what happens with Bette and Tina in the final episode. That is not an ending. That's another beginning. So where that goes, I don't know. And I feel the same way about all of these characters. And I feel the same way about the L word.
Let me ask you, you know, with the Showtime Paramount merger, what do you see as some possible options. Like, would you ever do the real L Word again? Like, reboot that with like a younger cast?
I wouldn't, but someone might. I'm not. I'm,
why would? I mean, why wouldn't you?
Well, firstly, I don't make that kind of television. And although it was my idea and it was really fun to do, I didn't do it in a hands-on way. And I don't know that I would go there again just because it's not what I do. I also wouldn't be the one to do it now because I think that that kind of show should be made by people in their 20s.
You know, something that I was really excited about was, I know that you and Jennifer had the rights to adapt The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo.
Yeah.
What is the status with that?
That the project isn't going forward. I love the book and I hope that somebody makes it. And Jennifer and I are working on a number of things together. Jennifer and I really have a great kind of creative, collaborative relationship, and we have several other projects that we're talking about.
Yeah, I was disappointed to see that, like, that wasn't, because I love that book and so many of my friends love that book. Yeah. Like, no other, like, what happened? I mean, I don't know.
It actually had more to do with business than creative. It was at the time when Disney was buying Fox, and I was in a deal there, and this happened and that happened, and it just didn't fit in with the new plans for the new company.
I guess the final question I'll ask you, and thank you so much for your time, do you feel that you're misunderstood in any way?
I hope so. I would hate to be fully known and understood. I mean, I'm sure that there are some misapprehensions about me, but it's not my business to know what they are or correct them.
I know you've talked about during the original airing that you would actually read like back then there really wasn't social media. So it was like message boards and you would read the comment, we would read posts and sometimes it would like affect you. How did you manage to deal with that?
You just have to decide that you're going to kind of push forward and make choices and stand behind the choices you make.
Are you ever just like, all right, enough with the L Word?
Oh, God, no. No.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you can mention that you're working on right now? Like anything that we should keep an eye out in the next year?
I'm working on a few projects that I love almost as much as I love the L Word. And hopefully when they come to fruition, I'll get to talk to you again.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This was great. Right.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. You too. Thanks so much for listening. You can follow me, JessXNYC, across all social media, Instagram, and definitely subscribe to the YouTube channel that is Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and my name, Jess Rothschild, where you can watch videos of all of these interviews.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream. That's a Lemke special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.